Hello. Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, April 28th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. We'll begin with the mini editorial, which today was written by Frank Gruber of Sioux City. And Frank writes, in response to the April 25th mini, because Mr. Trump wants to keep immigration as a campaign issue, he told Speaker Johnson not to submit any bills to help solve the immigration problems. Don't blame the Dems. Blame Mr. Trump. And again, this was written by Frank Gruber of Sioux City. We'll begin today with some stories from the tornadoes that happened in eastern Nebraska and southwestern Iowa Friday afternoon and evening, and there's a possibility of some more bad, severe weather on Saturday and Sunday. Tornadoes tore through eastern Nebraska and southwestern Iowa Friday afternoon, leaving people homeless, hurt, and trapped inside basements and businesses. Reports of damage came in from Lincoln, Waverly, the Elkhorn area of northwest Omaha, Bennington, Washington County in Nebraska, and from Pottawatomie County in Iowa. Minden, Iowa was hit particularly hard. Tornadoes destroyed multiple homes in the Elkhorn area, completely leveling and ripping the roofs off others there, as well as in the Bennington area. The window was just shaking in and out. We just saw a whole bunch of dust, inhaled a bunch of dust, and then it just started shattering, said Cohen Filter, standing amid debris outside his family's destroyed home near 216th and West Maple Road. He said he and his stepmother and sister were in the house but were not injured. They had taken shelter in the basement just before the tornado hit. The storm blew down trees and power lines, leaving thousands of people without power and many roads closed. There were no immediate reports of deaths or serious injuries in Omaha. Fire and police chiefs said early Friday evening they knew only of some minor injuries. There were also reports of people being rescued after they were trapped in their basements. Governor Jim Pillen said, Nebraskans are no strangers to severe weather, and as they have countless times before, Nebraskans will help Nebraskans to rebuild. A tornado struck a BNSF train between Waverly and Lincoln, causing multiple cars to derail. Epley Airfield, where flights were delayed by hours, suffered damage to the general aviation area and was closed down for about an hour as officials assessed the damage. Takaro Steel of Omaha and work colleagues Whitney Anderson, Susalyn Bittner, and Jessica Wellstead were in a plane sitting at Epley Airfield when they looked outside their windows and saw a tornado touch down a short distance away. It was scary as I don't know what, Steele said Friday night. I'm still pacing. School kids were kept inside across metropolitan Omaha, like at Omaha's Washington Elementary School, where they watched movies and kept spirits up. Parents took shelter with children at their daycare centers and schools as the afternoon storms raged at pickup time. A reunification center was set up at Elkhorn Middle School for parents who needed to pick up their children after several area schools were in lockdown during their tornado warnings. Emergency personnel set up command posts as sirens screamed and the Red Cross and Salvation Army began arranging help across the area. I am still scared, Bennington resident Sharon Childer said Friday afternoon. She saw law enforcement all over her area and houses without the roofs from her front porch near 180th and Bennington Road. It would be days or longer before the full breadth of the severe weather, which spent hours spawning multiple tornadoes, large hail, and punishing rain, is clear. While the Midwest is used to spring storms, what hit the area on Friday will leave damage for years. Matt Holliner, Omaha World Herald meteorologist, said at least seven tornadoes hit near Omaha, Lincoln, and western Iowa. There is a good chance that number may increase after the surveys, though, he said. He also said a tornado may have touched down, lifted, and touched down again, making the early count difficult. In the coming days, the National Weather Service will assess what category the tornadoes fell into. U.S. Representative Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska, visited damaged areas and said he believes at least 100 homes were destroyed. He said it was a miracle that there were no reports of fatalities by Friday evening. Pillen said he and his administration are working with local officials, emergency management directors, and law enforcement leaders in the aftermath. Bacon also said discussions with the White House and federal emergency officials had begun, and he expected a federal disaster declaration in the coming days. Pillen said in a statement, "I have ordered that state resources be made available to assist with the emergency response and to support local first responders as they assess the damage. Nebraskans are tough, resilient people, and our neighbors and our communities will rally around affected families and businesses to assist them." Pillen's office said people in affected areas should avoid downed power lines and follow all law enforcement directives as work continues to assess the damage. The blast that leveled Filter's family's house was part of a powerful hit-and-run tornado that flattened or damaged dozens of homes in the Elkhorn neighborhood. But Omaha Police Chief Todd Schmader said the city was fortunate to have so few injuries. Despite the destruction, only two people were transported to hospitals, both with minor injuries, he said. He attributed that remarkable number to the city's early warning systems, which gave those in the path time to take shelter. Schmader said, "It seems like our warning systems in the city of Omaha and Douglas County and the surrounding area were highly effective. We were not hit upon by a sudden storm. People had warning of this." City fire crews responded to 3:50 p.m. calls in Elkhorn at 2:15 and Maple saw wreckage. "It appears that many houses are flattened and many houses have suffered significant damage," Omaha Fire Chief Kathy Bossman said. "Fire officials plan to work through the night, making a detailed canvas of the neighborhood looking for injured people." Bossman said fire officials were facing numerous obstacles, including downed power lines, power outages, and gas leaks. She said the city was also sending up an emergency shelter to help those whose homes were damaged. Officials said the storm that hit Elkhorn tracked from 215th and Maple north to Fort Street, affecting the Ramblewood, Arbor Ridge, and Arbor View neighborhoods. There were also reports of significant damage in both Waterloo and Bennington within the county. After venting its fury on Elkhorn, the storm headed north and cut a swath through the rolling hills southwest of Bennington. Jeannie Brown never saw the tornado before it tore through the yard of her hilltop home on 186th Street, just north of State Street. She said, "I was in the basement because I heard it was going to hit Waterloo and Elkhorn. Then we lost power. We had a lot of wind. We came upstairs to this and all of our trees are gone." Her brick home was intact, at least, though it was splattered with mud. Some siding was gone and the windows were broken. The street in front of her house was blocked with broken trees. "I have lived here my entire life and I have never been through anything like this," she said. "We didn't lose anything you can't replace." About a mile away, the storm also caused widespread damage in the Woodlands Crossing neighborhood near 180th and Military Road. South of Blair in Washington County, Kim and James Adams were watching the storm from their home on an acreage. "The wind started picking up around 4 p.m. and the storm started sounding like a freight train," Kim said. She and James hurried to the basement with their two Springer Spaniel dogs. Meanwhile, their three outdoor cats found shelter in the couple's garage. "We were really, really close to the storm," Kim said. "I told my daughter that we thought the tornado was 200 to 2,000 feet from our house," James added. "We weren't sure how close it was, but it was very close." While their home was spared by the tornado, whose funnel cut a wide path but passed just north of their home, the structure had damage on every side. The tornado either uprooted, snapped, or somehow destroyed 30 trees on their property, many of which were more than 60 years old. The tornado also destroyed a swing set James had been building for his 5-year-old granddaughter and also bent a flagpole to the ground. Still, the couple consider themselves extremely lucky. Just north of their acreage, neighboring homes on both sides of Blair High Road were destroyed, and power poles snapped, leaving wires on the ground and the Adams without power. Omaha Public Power District was on hand to begin repair and recovery. And now we'll move to another article about David Schultz and the recovery of his body. A spokesman for David Schultz's family told the Journal Friday they plan to have a private forensic pathology firm conduct a second autopsy on the Wall Lake, Iowa trucker's body. Jake Rowley of the United Cajun Navy said Schultz's wife, Sarah, gave him permission to set up a GoFundMe online fundraiser. He said they hope to raise at least $10,000 to cover the cost of a second autopsy, as well as Schultz's funeral expenses. Shortly before 2 p.m. Wednesday, an unidentified man reported to the Sac County Sheriff's Office that he found a body in his farm field, according to a statement from the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, or DCI. The farm field is located in the 1900 block of Union Avenue in Sac County, roughly 1.5 miles from where Schultz's semi-tractor trailer loaded with hogs was discovered abandoned the afternoon of November 21st, the same day the 53-year-old father of 10-year-old twin boys was reported missing. He was last heard from in the early morning hours of November 21st. "I don't feel comfortable with the results of the initial autopsy," Rowley said by phone. "I think, definitely, in my opinion and in Sarah's opinion, both in our conversations together, foul play was involved." Late Thursday afternoon, the DCI announced in a statement that the Iowa Office of the State Medical Examiner conducted a forensic autopsy on the body and positively identified it as that of Schultz through dental records. The statement said, "Preliminary autopsy results show no signs of trauma or serious injury. Further autopsy test results are pending. Authorities do not suspect foul play in the death of Schultz." Rowley and Sarah Schultz are looking into sending the body to Kansas City for the private autopsy, since those services are not available in Iowa, according to Rowley. He said they are working with the Farber and Ottoman Funeral Homes to first transport the body from the State Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny to Sac City. "Not that I do not trust the officials and what they do. I definitely do," said Rowley, who noted some test results, such as toxicology, have not come back. "Though there's other parts of this that haven't been completely returned yet. There may be something in that, you know, that hasn't been brought to our attention yet." Schultz's red Peterbilt semi with white stripes was parked in the middle of the northbound lane of County Road N14, not far from where it intersects with D15. The trailer he rented was loaded with pigs, but Schultz was nowhere to be found on that stretch of paved roadway, which is flanked by cornfields. The truck was reportedly shut off, the lights were off, and the key was in the ignition. Deputies found Schultz's wallet and cell phone inside. A towel, cell phone charger, and pocket knife were found with his coat on the opposite side of the road, according to Sac County Sheriff Ken McClure. During a news conference Thursday morning, Sarah Schultz, who had not yet viewed the body, had a hard time grasping how it wasn't just bones. From what she understands, her husband's body was found on its back, clad in a t-shirt, which was pulled up. "He had underwear on, and I think his jeans were down. His cowboy boots were on, I think," she said, "or the brown Wrangler boots with blue on the soles. I know that they identified him by the boots, because the last time he went and bought boots, he bought two pairs of the exact same ones. I gave the sheriff one of the newer boots to have for comparison." No matter the weather or the occasion, Schultz always wore cowboy boots, according to his wife. "He always wore them in the summer and the winter. It did not matter. He didn't wear work boots, just always cowboy boots and jeans," Schultz said as she stood outside the white, single-story Sac City Motel, her shoulder-length, wavy, light brown hair blowing in the wind. "He did not like it when truck drivers would wear sweatpants and flip-flops. To him, that's just appalling. It's disgusting. He does not respect that. He feels like he's representing the trucking community." Schultz, who works as a safety coordinator for EVAPCO in Lakeview, said she has felt relief and sorrow since her husband's body was discovered in the freshly tilled field. She said her boss tricked her into going in for a car ride Wednesday. Since it was such a nice day out, she got into his truck. As he drove, they talked about work stuff. When they got to Schultz's house, she said he grabbed her hand and told her the sheriff wanted to talk to her. That's when Schultz, who had a feeling her husband would be found when farmers were readying their fields, said she knew what had happened. "I'm glad we know where he is," Schultz said, her brown eyes welling up with tears. "There's still a lot of questions. You know, things just don't make sense." Riley told the Journal Wednesday evening, after Schultz's body had been found, the body was located in the original 2-mile radius that he had been told law enforcement searched. He said the United Cajun Navy, a nonprofit search and rescue organization which scoured more than 100,000 acres in and around Sac County looking for Schultz, did not search that particular area. Sarah Schultz even recalled a thermal imaging drone from the Iowa Department of Transportation flying over. During that interview, Riley also asserted that Schultz's body was in a state of decomposition inconsistent with having been out in the elements for more than 5 months. The body, he said, was not as decomposed as it should have been under the circumstances, implying that it may have been discarded later. There's a very good chance that the body wasn't there even when they searched, Riley speculated, referring to the search conducted by local law enforcement and emergency responders, and that the body was placed there after. On Friday, Riley said, from his understanding, Schultz's body was unrecognizable outside of the cowboy boots and the dental records. Trying to be able to do a thorough autopsy on a body that has a state of decomposition is hard, and so maybe something was missed. Maybe it wasn't, he said. I'm not an autopsy professional. I'm a search and rescue professional. When it comes to these things, I have to count on the professionals to do what they do, and that's kind of why we're looking at doing a second autopsy. Riley remarked, autopsy are not cheap, and said he's looking into a fund the state has for crime victims. However, he said Schultz's family likely would not be able to tap into that fund to cover funeral expenses, since authorities don't believe foul play was involved at this time. He said he was quoted $6,950 for basic funeral services and $550 to transport the body to Kansas City for an autopsy. He is still waiting to hear how much the second autopsy will cost, but estimates the funeral, body transport, and autopsy to be in the neighborhood of $10,000. Like Sarah said yesterday, there's very little reason that David would have just stopped that truck on the side of the road, just walked away from it, and then walked a mile and a half out in the middle of a field and laid down. There's just almost no reason why David would have done that. If there was no foul play, if nobody else was involved in it, then why did David do that? That's a big question, Riley said. I think, as far as bringing closure to Sarah and the boys and his parents and the Schultz family, we probably need to go to all ends to try to figure out what happened. The next story is from South Sioux City with the headline, Volunteers Use New Growing Methods on Orchard. An old adage says, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. South Sioux City Community Orchard volunteers hope to turn the heaping helping of lemons they have received the past couple of winters into apple pie. Rather than bemoan the fact that rabbits killed more than 100 apple trees, leaving only about a dozen, volunteers are replanting, and they will take advantage of the opportunity to implement new growing methods learned while raising the previous trees. We have got an opportunity to do something different, said Carol Larvik, Emeritus University of Nebraska Extension Educator and Master Gardener, who helped develop the orchard, which is owned by the city and maintained by city workers and volunteers. On Wednesday, Larvik and other volunteers planted about 40 young apple trees. Along with 15 to 20 planted last fall, they have begun the task of reestablishing an apple orchard that was nearly decimated. Things have been looking up just 2 years ago, when the 100-plus apple trees, well into fruit-bearing, producing age, were fulfilling the orchard's mission of providing free fruit to South Sioux City residents and serving as a tool to educate community members about how to include fresh fruit into their eating habits. During a public event in September 2022, 370 people, including volunteers, picked 776 pounds of apples. The apples attracted 736 visitors to the orchard that year. During freezing weather, a month later, hungry rabbits took advantage of drifted snow that allowed them to chew off tender bark above rabbit guards on the tree's trunks. More than 100 trees were lost, leaving about 25 that had not yet reached fruit-bearing age. This past winter, drifting snow enabled rabbits to finish off most of the remaining trees. At that point, you just have to move forward, Larvik said. After planting a handful of trees last fall, they all survived the latest rabbit attack. Volunteers made plans to plant more this spring. There was little discussion needed when it came to replanting, City Parks Director Jean Maffitt said. The orchard is an important project for the city, attracting children and adults alike. Grant funds were secured to buy the new trees from a Missouri nursery. Maffitt said it was never a question when it happened that they were going to be replaced. As the latest orchard additions take root, Larvik said volunteers will use lessons learned from mistakes made during past years and implement knowledge gained from other orchard experts. Volunteers learned pruning methods that maximize sunlight and air movement through the trees to produce more fruit. Better water management practices will be implemented. New trees will be pruned higher so that the lowest branches are out of the rabbit's reach. Trees won't be planted in areas where the snow has piled up highest. Larvik said, where the biggest drift was, I'm not putting a tree then there. And 100 new rabbit guards, a better version of those used before, were bought to protect the trees. Larvik said she used them at her home and they really work well. It's about all they can do to protect the apple trees. Fences are mostly useless because rabbits can burrow under them. At this point, I'm not sure what else we can do, Larvik said. As the new trees grow, Larvik and the rest of the volunteers will hone their orchard skills and continue to add apple trees in coming years to replace those lost. The plan is to plant more, she said. Fortunately, the rabbits left most of the other fruit trees alone, and Larvik said she expects to be picking plums, pears, and cherries this year. There are only a handful of those trees, not enough to produce quantity sufficient to open the orchard up to public picking. That likely will not happen again until the new apple trees reach maturity. It will be about 5 years before we have enough apples to share with the community, Larvik said. A sweet reward after the sour experiences of the past 2 years. I'll now move to some news briefs. Woman pleads not guilty of stealing painkillers, Sioux City. A former delivery driver for an Onawa, Iowa pharmacy has pleaded not guilty of stealing prescription opioids from a former customer's home. Sarah Haptonstall, 46 of Onawa, waived her right to appear in person for an arraignment and filed a written plea Wednesday in the U.S. District Court in Sioux City to single counts of acquiring and attempting to acquire a controlled substance by misrepresentation, fraud, deception, and subterfuge, and possession of a firearm by a felon. Haptonstall was a delivery driver for Stengel Pharmacy in 2021 and later resigned after it was discovered she was stealing drugs. According to court documents, Haptonstall broke into former customers' homes after she no longer worked for the pharmacy and stole drugs. She's accused of stealing prescription pills and oxycodone from an Onawa home on March 8, 2023. Sheriff's deputies interviewed her and searched her vehicle, finding a 9mm pistol. She was prohibited from possession of firearms because of a previous conviction for stealing drugs. Several empty prescription bottles also were found. Haptonstall was charged in April 2023 in Monona County District Court with stealing prescription drugs from at least three homes. Monona County prosecutors have filed a motion to dismiss the charges in wake of Haptonstall's indictment in federal court. Haptonstall was placed on probation in Monona County in February 2023 after pleading guilty of swapping out 10 hydrocodone tablets with Tylenol and keeping the hydrocodone for herself while she was a delivery driver for the pharmacy. Man pleads not guilty to federal sex charges. Omaha. A Macy, Nebraska man has pleaded not guilty of child sexual abuse. Jason Walker, 53, waived his right to appear in person for arraignment and entered a written plea Monday in U.S. District Court in Omaha to two counts of aggravated sexual abuse with children and two counts of abusive sexual contact with a child under age 12. Walker is accused of having sexual contact with the child during a two-year period that began about December 1, 2021 and continued until January 31st. Woman gets probation for animal neglect, Storm Lake. Two Storm Lake women have been placed on probation and ordered to pay thousands of dollars in restitution for animal neglect. Veronica Lopez Munez, 33, and Juana Munez, 63, both were sentenced Monday in Buena Vista County District Court to a five-year suspended prison sentence and 3 years probation. Both had pleaded guilty to one count of felony animal neglect. They were ordered to pay more than $12,000 in restitution jointly with Myra Lopez-Moniz to the Storm Lake Police Department and the Lake Animal Hospital. All three were arrested in September after authorities found 13 cats, all sick with respiratory infections, fleas, and ear mites, at their home in the 1,000 block of Michigan Street. Two kittens had severe eye infections and each had lost an eye. Myra Lopez-Moniz previously pleaded guilty to animal neglect and also received a 5-year suspended prison sentence and 3 years probation. The three previously were arrested in May 2019 when authorities removed 30 dogs and 21 cats from the same home, which at the time reeked of animal waste. Myra Lopez-Moniz eventually pleaded guilty of misdemeanor animal neglect and was fined $130. Veronica Lopez-Moniz and Juana Moniz both pleaded guilty of misdemeanor child endangerment because a teenager was living in the home at the time. Both were placed on probation. Woman sentenced to prison for burning truck, Sioux City. A Sioux City woman who set fire to her brother's pickup truck was sentenced Thursday to 10 years in prison. Christy Lamb, 25, pleaded guilty in January in Woodbury County District Court to one count of second-degree arson. As part of a plea agreement, a charge of second-degree criminal mischief was dismissed. The plea agreement did not contain a sentencing agreement, and District Judge Roger Saylor imposed the prison sentence and ordered Lamb to pay $2,328 restitution. Police and emergency personnel responded to the fire in the 2300 block of West 14th Street on August 12th. The vehicle's owner and his mother viewed surveillance footage and identified Lamb, the victim's sister, as the person seen setting fire to the vehicle, a 2003 Dodge Dakota. Video showed Lamb poured an accelerant on the pickup and lit it on fire. 2 days later, Lamb went to a relative's house in Sergeant Bluff, where she discarded clothing prior to being arrested on an outstanding warrant for theft. Sioux City fire investigators recovered the clothing, which matched clothing the suspect was wearing in the surveillance footage and smelled like gasoline. Sioux City Schools' free summer meal program begins June 3rd. Free summer meals for children in Sioux City will begin June 3rd and continue through July 26th. The Sioux City Schools announced Thursday they will again participate in the Summer Food Service Program, which provides free meals to students during the summer. Meals are available Monday through Friday for all children ages 1 through 18 at certain schools in the area. Other schools in the area offer meals only to students who are signed up for the program. Our next story, Come On Down, Nebraskan Wins on The Price Is Right. A 23-year-old La Vista man won a lot more than pocket change in an episode of The Price is Right that aired Monday. J.P. Jensen, an Omaha native and University of Nebraska-Lincoln graduate, won a 2024 Hyundai Elantra Hybrid on the show after figuring out the car's price of $27,645 in the game Pocket Change. Jensen said he's been a fan of the show since childhood and even tried to arrange a schedule in college around the show's airtime so he could watch it. For the last few years, Jensen, who works in computer security for an insurance company in Lincoln, said he has recorded the show so he can watch it at night. On March 5th, Jensen traveled to the Los Angeles area to watch an episode of the show filmed. Contestants on the show are chosen from the audience. He said they asked you where you're from and what you do. They look for people with energy, and they look for people with interesting stories. Jensen apparently caught the eyes of producers, as his name was called first to compete. The news still shocked me, even though I had that inkling I might get called, he said. Jensen was unsuccessful in guessing the prices of a few items, but then was selected to play Pocket Change. In the game, the contestant is given the digits for the price of an item out of order and must figure out the correct price from those digits. When the contestant selects a digit correctly, they collect an envelope containing a value between $0 to $2. The contestant tries to collect enough money to total the price, which starts at 25 cents. For each incorrect guess, the price of the item goes up by 25 cents. Jensen was given the first digit of the car's price, 2. and got the second digit, 7, correct on the first try. He eventually got the full price correct, but ended up making a few mistakes, which brought the value of the car to $1. Once host Drew Carey began opening the envelopes, Jensen was 65 cents short of the total he needed before the last envelope was opened. However, Jensen was lucky and ended up getting the only 75-cent card out of 20. Drew goes, "I have bad news. You're going to have to pay taxes on a brand new car," Jensen said. The moment felt surreal, and Jensen said, "It's still sinking in. In a way, I still honestly can't believe that actually happened," he said. Due to supply chain issues, producers notified Jensen after the show that he would not actually be getting a car, but instead will receive a check for the value of it. Jensen said he might put some of the money toward a car of his own choosing. "Probably not a new one," he said. "I like my classics. I drive a 92 Taurus, and I'm thinking of maybe getting something even older than that." You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, April 28th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to the obituaries for today. Joyce E. Harrison, 89, of Sioux City, formerly of Kingsley, passed away peacefully on Monday, April 22nd, at her home at Northern Hills Assisted Living, surrounded by family. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Monday, April 29th, at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley, with Pastor Bob Dillman officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday, April 28th, followed by a prayer service led by Josh Carr and 2 hours prior to services on Monday. Interment will be at the Kingsley Cemetery. Joyce Elizabeth Harrison was born June 20th, 1934, to Mildred E. Luscombe and Charles Sutherland. She spent her early years in Sioux City, then moved to a farm outside of Kingsley after her mother and Charles divorced. Her mother later married Leon Gernhardt, who she affectionately knew as Day. Joyce attended Garfield No. 5 Country School through the 7th grade until the school closed, then finished her schooling in Kingsley. Joyce was united in marriage to Nolan Harrison on October 11, 1951. They lived on a farm west of Kingsley until a fire destroyed their home. They then moved to town across from the old school until they purchased their home on South Hill, where they lived for over 30 years and raised their 10 children. Joyce worked tirelessly taking care of her kids, helping Nolan in his repair shop, and helping farm their small acreage north of town. After the last of her kids were grown, Joyce drove bus for the KP School District for many years, and after Nolan died in 1987, she took on another job at Woodbury Homestead in Sioux City. It was there that she met John Trapper Egink, who later became her companion of over 20 years until his death in 2010. Joyce had a competitive nature and enjoyed playing games, especially Sorry, Sequence, and Euchre, and going to the casino to play slots. She often spoke of her favorite road trip to the Black Hills with her daughter, Sherry. Most days, you would find her sitting in her recliner reading the newspaper or intently working on her word search puzzles. She loved listening to classic country music and going to concerts. Her Alexa was well-trained and would play cowboy country music for her, even when she called her Alyssa or Alicia, similar to her running through the list of her kids' names before landing on the right one. Joyce was especially proud of her family. Though dementia stole pieces of her memory, she never forgot or missed an opportunity to boast of her 10 kids and her many grandkids whom she loved and adored. A special thank you to all of Mom's caregivers over the past few months, including Roy and Cindy, who cared for her in their home, those at Holy Spirit, Mercy Hospital, Kingsley Specialty Care, Hospice of Siouxland, and Heritage at Northern Hills Assisted Living, who made Mom's hopes of going home a reality. Mom will always be remembered for her spunk, tenacity, and her ability to work her way back from seemingly hopeless situations. She was one of the toughest old birds you'd ever meet and was so dearly loved by us all. Memorials may be directed to Siouxland Humane Society, where Mom enjoyed visiting and would faithfully donate her newspapers for bedding. Colleen A. Ebner, 62, of Sloan, died April 24th. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 30th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Salix. Visitation will be Monday from 4 to 7 p.m. with rosary at 4 p.m. all at the church. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery in Salix. Arrangements are through Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Robert J. Bob Morrissey, 85, of Sioux City, passed away on Tuesday, April 23rd. Arrangements are pending at Byer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Kathleen Jones Green of Sioux City passed away peacefully on Friday, April 12th. A celebration of Kathleen's life will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, May 3rd, at Mayflower Congregational Church at 1407 West 18th Street in Sioux City. Martin Marty Arnold Goebbels passed away on April 17th. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, July 9th at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Interment will be at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. with a vigil service at 5 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Marty, born 1926, was one of 12 children born to Peter and Mary Goebbels of Hartington, Nebraska. Marty enlisted in the Army shortly after his 18th birthday. While stationed at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, he transferred to the Navy and then to the Seabees, even though he did not know how to swim and had never seen a large body of water. He was stationed stateside before going to Guam in 1945. After the war, Marty returned to Nebraska and enrolled in barber school in Sioux City. He married Teresa Signer, deceased May 10, 2010, of Vail, Iowa in 1950. They were active members of St. Joseph Catholic Church and school. Marty owned Marty's Barbershop in Cecilia Park and Morningside Avenue. For the past 20 years, Marty lived at the Sunrise Retirement Community, where he was honored for his volunteer work. Over the years, Marty enjoyed hunting, Heelan football, and many fishing trips to Minnesota, Canada, and Alaska. He was active playing cards, planting container flower and vegetable gardens, and leading the rosary. Marty was an enthusiastic volunteer of Queen of Peace Trinity Heights from its inception and continued to support until he turned 92. Marty said his best praying was done while mowing the grass around the statue of Mary. Marty's Catholic faith was very important to him. It took him most of the morning to pray for people in need of his prayers. You honor him by continuing to pray the rosary. The family appreciates your kind words and sharing of stories. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made to Trinity Heights Queen of Peace, Heelan Catholic High School, or a charity of your choice. Jill Ann Haver of Wakanda, South Dakota, passed away suddenly at home on Tuesday evening, April 23rd, at the age of 74. Jill was born February 23, 1950, to R.D. Dewey and LaVon Bonnie Helford in Sac City, Iowa. She grew up in Sioux City and graduated from East High School in 1968. She then attended Morningside College and graduated with a double major in business and economics in 1972. Jill worked for various banks and met the love of her life, John Haver, in Omaha in 1974. They moved back to Wakanda in 1975 and married on October 30, 1975. Jill was a city girl, but enjoyed being in the country. They had two children, a daughter, Erin, born in 1981, and a son, Ryan, born in 1984. She was always proud of being able to stay home and raise her children. She also helped John on the farm, sorting hogs and hauling grain. Jill and John enjoyed attending their children's events and later in-life events for their grandchildren. They also traveled more after the kids were out of the house and made a few trips to Hawaii, Alaska, and most recently were in Frisco, Texas to see the Jacks win the FCS championship. Maui was an especially treasured place, and she was devastated when the fire happened in Lahaina. Jill loved her pets, especially her cats. Her family members fondly referred to as the Crazy Cat Lady. A very special one, Buddy, is mourning her passing, but she absolutely adored her grandchildren. They were her pride and joy and will miss her a great deal. She was very active in the Wakanda United Methodist Church and the Wakanda Legion Auxiliary. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we'll start with an article from the Journal Editorial Board, which is kind of multiple things that they're talking about today. The first one, the Sioux City Musketeers are back in the USHL Western Conference Finals for the second time in three seasons. The Muskies swept the Lincoln Stars in the semifinals and will now meet the Fargo Force in the Conference Championship Series. The best of five series opens in Fargo on Sunday, with Game 2 also set for Monday in the North Dakota City. Tickets went on sale Friday for Games 3 and 4, which will be played May 2nd and May 3rd, respectively, at the Tyson Events Center. The winner advances to the championship series for the Clark Cup, which Sioux City brought home two seasons ago. If you wondered what makes Taylor Swift such a phenomenon, you might want to mark July 6th on your calendar. That's the day her longtime producer, Jack Antonoff, and his band Bleachers headlined Saturday in the Park. For long time Saturday in the Park goers, it's another interesting lineup, one that should educate as well as entertain. Other main stage acts include Brooklyn-based pop artist Del Watergap, South Carolina-born singer-songwriter Nikki Lane, and Mike Campbell and the Dirty Knobs, featuring Mike Campbell, a longtime guitarist for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Several Northwest Iowa companies and products are competing for the first ever Coolest Thing Made in Iowa competition. The nominees include Jolly Time Popcorn in Sioux City, Wells Blue Bunny Ice Cream in Lamar's, and Gomaco's Vintage Trolleys in Ida Grove. It goes to show how much there is to the area and what we have to offer. To register your support for those and other products, cast a vote online at, and I'll read the website, www.coolestthingia.com/contest-information/vote. The next item. We predicted there'd be a problem with card-only parking ramps, and we were right. Officials said a motorist broke a gate arm at the Heritage Ramp Tuesday night. A tactic called piggybacking occurs when someone tries to make it through when the arm goes up for someone else. While it may have happened with the old system too, it seems strange that someone would risk car damage just to avoid paying. We still say a cash option should be in play. And speaking of parking ramps, the one near the Orpheum Theater had attendants helping drivers operate the new machines Wednesday night. That improved the learning curve and had a cash option. The theater's clear bags policy, however, continues to surprise patrons and prompted trips back to cars to stash their not-so-clear purses. We'll now move on to the letters to the editor. And the first one is written by Kelly Neuwenhuis of Primgar, Iowa. And Kelly writes, "Farmers wear many hats. We build our operations by anticipating the weather, our economy, and other market trends, and more. Every day is a new challenge, and with those challenges must come new solutions, carbon capture and sequestration pipelines being part of the latter. As our state awaits the Iowa Utility Board's decision on permitting Summit Carbon Solutions Pipeline and the proposed route, I want Iowans to know that the future of the biofuels industry is at stake with this investment in our infrastructure. The impact ethanol has on Iowa's economy cannot be overstated, and I want the industry to be successful even after I retire from farming. Like many Iowa farmers, we ship 100% of our personally produced corn to ethanol plants, knowing the value of the biofuels it produces. SCS's pipeline will allow farmers, like me, to sell corn in the expanding low-carbon fuel markets and participate in the promising future of the biofuels industry. The pipeline is a way to maintain the billions of dollars in GDP and hundreds of thousands of jobs that ethanol provides nationally, putting Iowa in a position to lead. Carbon capture and sequestration is a part of the future, and this project utilizes long-standing technology to achieve that future. We can face the changing markets with the same optimism and innovation that farmers have always brought to the table. Join me in being part of the solution." And again, this was written by Kelly Neuwenhuis of Primgar, Iowa. The next letter to the editor is written by Melanie Becker, treasurer of the Humane Society of Northwest Iowa, Milford. And she writes, "Animal lovers in Iowa might be barking up the wrong tree when donating to their favorite cause. Polling shows most people wrongly believe that America's biggest national animal charities, the Humane Society of the United States, or HSUS, and the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, ASPCA, are umbrella groups for the local shelters. But that is far from the truth. HSUS and the ASPCA only give 1% and 2% of their respective budgets to local pet shelters. Unfortunately, widespread name confusion is hurting local operations like ours. At the Humane Society of Northwest Iowa, we often hear from supporters who are surprised and disappointed to learn that their donation to a national group is not funding our life-saving work here in Iowa. When our shelter desperately needed financial assistance this spring to complete crucial building repairs, both groups turned down our request for financial aid. Our Iowa neighbors deserve to know all the facts about where their donations go. My advice? To help deserving pets in our state, forget the national charities and give to your local shelter instead." And this was written by Melanie Becker, treasurer of the Humane Society of Northwest Iowa, Milford. And our third letter to the editor today is written by Sandra Egdorf from Hinton. And Sandra writes, "The uneducated protesters in support of Palestine need a reality kick in the backside. How about a video showing the beyond horrific acts of Hamas, burning babies alive in front of their mothers, decapitating infants in front of their mothers, mothers being raped and burned in front of their children who will be scarred for life if they live. The tortures go on and on. Mainstream media has failed to demonstrate these acts by Hamas and only inform of the acts of Israel towards Hamas. How civilized can war be? Israel has found only one way to protect innocent collateral harm to Palestinians. How many countries in active war actually give prior notice that they will be making a military move and to get out of the area? Has that ever happened in the history of warfare? No. If a group of murderous insurgents attack the United States and chose infanticide and genocide of innocent persons in order to make a point, would we just bend over and take it? Sadly, the students living off their parents and financial supporters would not lift a finger to say, fellow Americans, to support Palestine should not be supporting Hamas." Again, this was written by Sandra Egdorf of Hinton, Iowa. We'll now move to the sports section, and we have some results from the Drake Relays for some local athletes. Tierney Huss is a Drake Relays champion in the girls' 100-meter dash. Huss, a senior at MOC Floyd Valley, beat Panorama's Jaden Sellers by decimal points, edging the reigning Drake Relays champion by 0.006 seconds on Friday at Drake Stadium for the Day 2 of the track and field games on the Blue Oval in Des Moines. The event itself got started earlier in the week with the Drake Road Races. Behind Huss and Sellers is Sioux City East senior Eliana Harris, a South Dakota State University track recruit, was third at 12.16. Huss also anchored a third place 4x200 relay for the Dutch that finished in a time of 1 minute 43.66 seconds. Kaylee Tucker ran the lead leg and gave way to Maggie McEwen. Adi Jeltma ran third before Huss finished it off. "It's awesome," said Huss, a four-time Drake Relays qualifier who took seventh in the 100 at the event last season. "I never could have imagined anything like this or to have an opportunity like this to come out here and compete. After getting seventh last year, I didn't think I would have a chance to win." MOC Floyd's 800 sprint medley relay finished eighth with a time of 1 minute 50.69 seconds. Tuka ran leadoff and handed to Peyton Kleinhesslink. Huss ran the third leg and Jeltma ran the final 400. I've done a lot of lifting and worked on my start, said Huss, a Northwestern College volleyball and track commit. That's what's been kind of keeping my time down, that and trusting in God's timing. It's a little bittersweet knowing this is my last Drake relays while I'm in high school, but hopefully I'll be able to get back here in college and get that same type of feeling. Spirit Lakes boys 1600 distance medley relay also finished in 8th behind the efforts of Ethan Stecker, Cooper Winkle, Cameron Hussey, and Ryder Sundahl. That group finished with a time of 3:37:15. Sophomore year, I was running against a bunch of Big Ten commits, Huss said. That made it very tough to do well at events like this. I didn't know if I'd ever make it to the top like they did, but at the end, I'm really glad I did. I started taking track very competitively around then, and it's paid off. And now we have a story about the NFL draft. One of the most decorated athletes Northwest Iowa has produced has a home in the National Football League. Old Ebolt native Cooper DeJean was drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles with the 8th pick in the 2nd round on Friday night during this year's draft, which is taking place in Detroit through Saturday. The Eagles traded up to acquire the pick. Philadelphia made it to the Super Bowl in 2022 and lost in the wild card round last season after finishing the regular season 11-6. After an illustrious prep career at OABCIG High School, DeJean started at the University of Iowa, where he was a unanimous All-American defensive back before declaring for the draft following his junior season. With the Hawkeyes, DeJean was a 2-time All-Big Ten selection at cornerback. This past fall, he won the Tatum Woodson Big Ten Defensive Back of the Year and Rogers Dwight Big Ten Return Specialist of the Year. He had 7 career interceptions at Iowa, with 3 returned for touchdowns. All 3 of those came in 2022, which set a school single-season record and tied the most for a career. DeJean, the son of Jason and Katie DeJean, played in 30 career games at Iowa and made 120 total tackles. As a returner, he turned 31 punt returns into 406 yards and a score. However, DeJean was unable to play in the Hawkeyes' final 4 games due to a fractured leg suffered during a mid-November practice. Due to the recovery process, he did not participate in any physical workouts at the NFL Draft Combine or at the Hawkeyes' Pro Day in mid-March, though he did attend the Combine in Indianapolis. He plays both cornerback and safety. Being able to play multiple different positions, I think that's an advantage coming into this league, to be able to play wherever they put me, DeJean told ESPN's Jeff Legwold at the Combine on February 29th. It doesn't matter to me, to be honest. I just want to play ball. And we'll now move to Dear Abby to finish out our letter. I am a teacher. I have a young son, and I love being off when he is out for school holidays and spending summers together. I feel I have the best of both worlds. I recently married a woman who is 14 years younger than me and is also a teacher. My wife hates the profession. She feels it isn't exciting or respectable enough. Her opinions about teaching hurt my feelings because I believe it is a noble career. Plus, it gives me quality time with my son. My wife has decided to join the police force. It didn't happen out of the blue. We have discussed it for the last 5 years. I have told her it isn't the life I want. I worked hard to reach a point in my life to have a family and take summer vacations with my son. I was honest with her from the beginning. She often says she wants the time with our family too, and that she won't join the police force. Then, days later, she brings it up again. We have been married only 6 months, but I regret it already. I didn't get married to be alone all the time and to take vacations without my spouse. I love her, but I feel betrayed and lied to. I also don't think she will be a good cop. She is just obsessed with police shows and thinks it's going to be like that. She's throwing away a great career for one I think she will leave in a year or two. I feel our biggest challenge is her lack of experience. What do I do? Signed, Worried Wife, Mom in Florida. And Abby's response, calm down. There is no guarantee that even if your wife applies, she will be accepted into law enforcement in anything more than an administrative capacity. Some sessions with a licensed marriage and family therapist might help the two of you to better communicate. You each appear to have very different ideas about what a happy marriage consists of. If a compromise cannot be reached, and because your marriage has been such a short one, it might be better for the two of you to cordially part ways. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, April 28th. I'm Dagna, your reader today. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.